It's Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll look at some of the unique, weird, and wonderful places off the beaten path with a co-author of the new book, Atlas Obscura.
First, with Election Day only 17 days away, as people head into the voting booth, they'll have to have more identification, notably photo ID, when they cast their ballots.
And for people voting absentee in Wisconsin, they'll need to submit their vote earlier than in the past. This could cause some problems for eligible voters. So far, more than 120,000 people have submitted their ballots by mail. Nearly 150,000 have voted absentee in person.
Joining us now to talk about the new absentee voting rule and all of the changes coming to the voting booth this year in Wisconsin is Andrea Kaminsky. She's the executive director of the League of Women Voters Wisconsin. Andrea, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So first, bring us up to speed on what these new changes are to absentee voting.
Well, for absentee voting, your ballot has to be received by your local clerk, your municipal clerk, by Election Day. It used to be that it just had to be postmarked by Election Day. And with the way the mail goes sometimes, and sometimes it's slower than you expect, what election officials are recommending is that you get it in the mail a week ahead of time. So that would be November 1st.
Just around the corner.
If you can. If you can't, go ahead and send it and hope it gets there by Election Day.
And remind us, who can request an absentee ballot?
Anybody, any voter can request an absentee ballot. You request it from your local clerk, or if you live in the city of Milwaukee, from the Milwaukee Election Commission. And you don't have to give any excuse. But at this point, if you're going to do that, I recommend that you do it very soon, because they will have to mail you the ballot, and then you've got to get it back by Election Day.
It's a very busy time of year, of course, for the League of Women Voters. What are some things you're paying close attention to in the days leading up to Election Day?
Well, one thing that we're doing is we're training we'll train election observers. We'll have about 300 volunteers in the polls on Election Day. They will be there to observe and to look at what are some problems at the polls for voters, what are some best practices. If there are problems that are immediate and we're concerned about somebody not getting a chance to vote, then they have numbers they can call to get assistance for that voter. At the same time, we're hearing that that there are going to be other election observers in the polls, as there always are, and we want to assure Wisconsin voters that there have been observers in the polls for a long time in our state. They have to follow rules. They are not allowed to disrupt voting process. And we expect that will happen again this time.
There were some election changes that came into the mix here since the last presidential election. One of the changes was buffer zone changes, where election officials can stand. But what are some of these election law changes that have come into effect since 2012?
Sure. The buffer rule is that observers have to stand in a certain spot so that they're not disrupting the voters. And that spot has moved a little bit, but it's still the same. Things that people will notice the most would be that now you show photo ID to receive a ballot. There is no specific card that's a voter ID in Wisconsin. There are seven types of ID that you can use, and they include what most people will do is a Wisconsin driver's license, Wisconsin state ID, a passport, a veteran's card, and you can get information at on a website called myvote.wi.gov. That is the Wisconsin voter information website. Pay attention to the expiration date. Some of these, like for your driver's license, you can use it even if it's recently expired in the last 2 years, you can still use it.
And for voters who lack a valid photo ID, they can apply for a voter ID at the DMV. Can you tell a little bit about that voter ID credentialing process through the DMV?
Sure. It's called the ID petition process. You go to your DMV the closest one, and you tell them you want a free ID for voting, or you want an ID that you can use for voting. And you should receive and bring with you whatever identification or documentation you can. If you have a birth certificate, be sure to bring that. If you have an expired driver's license from either Wisconsin or another state, bring that. Just your proof of residence. You will have to prove that you're a Wisconsin resident. And
so, an electricity bill, or
yes. And there's another website called bringit.wi.gov. which is the state's voter ID website, which is an excellent resource.
We're talking with Andrea Kaminsky. She's the executive director of the League of Women Voters Wisconsin. And Andrea, getting back now to the absentee ballot, we have also heard of absentee ballots not fully completed with the witness information, full addresses. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That's right. If you mail in your absentee ballot, you will, on the outside of the, it's called the certificate envelope, you have to sign it with your own name, your address should be there, and then you also have to have a U.S. citizen witness it, so they have to sign their name and they have to provide their address. If they provide an incomplete address, it may be that the local clerk can fill that in, but why not save your clerk time and make sure your ballot is counted, because they might not have the time and get that ballot in.
To fully complete it for any missing information.
Right.
Yeah. And what are you hearing from voters who are seeking more education about how to vote this year? Are there common questions that are being brought to the league?
Yes, there are. We have voter information on our website. It's lwvlikevoterwi.org. It's League of Women Voters of Wisconsin. That website I mentioned earlier, the Wisconsin voter information site, is also fantastic. You can go on there, type in your name and your birth date, and it'll tell you what your registration status is. If you're still an active voter, it'll tell you where your polling place is and show you what will be on your ballot. It's a great resource.
And when you request an absentee ballot, how soon must clerks respond to sending that ballot, by email or fax or in whatever way they send it? Is it within one business day?
Most of them send it right away.
Right away.
I don't know if there is a specific rule, but... Yeah.
And I noticed over the weekend a line in my local library to register to vote. Are you seeing a lot of number of people registering to vote?
I've heard that there are, I think, 9,000 people who have already voted, actually cast an in-person absentee ballot. It's called early voting in Madison. For registering, there are still people who need to register, and they should do so as soon as possible. And many municipalities do have opportunities to do that. At this point, if you're going to register, you have to do it either at your clerk's office or at a site that your clerk has designated. You can't do it by mail anymore. Or you can do it on election day at your polling place.
Andrea, thanks so much for spending time with us on this.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
That was Andrea Kaminsky. She's the executive director of the League of Women Voters Wisconsin.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we learn how to cook West African cuisine with recipes like mango chicken and West African rice salad.
Right now, if you're like me, when you go traveling, you see a lot of the big name attractions. I go to St. Louis, I see the Arch. I go to New Orleans, I go to Bourbon Street. I go to New York, I wait for hours in line to go to the top of the Empire State Building.
But our next guest says there's a lot more to see in the world than the big name attraction. And even in a world where the shopping malls and restaurants may start to look the same from place to place, there are lots of unique places filled with wonder.
Ella Morton is the associate editor of the Atlas Obscura website and co-author of the new book, Atlas Obscura, An Explorer's Guide to the World's Hidden Wonders. She's here now for the Wisconsin Book Festival. She's speaking tomorrow night at 9 at the Madison Public Library's Central Branch. Ella, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, tell us about the mission of Atlas Obscura. What are you trying to find and then share with people?
We are trying to uncover the world's hidden wonders. So we're looking for things that inspire awe and a sense of what is possible in the world. And that can be anything from a 200-foot-wide flaming hole in the Turkmenistan desert or a Victorian space machine that's been built by one guy who just woke up and decided that that was the meaning of his life from now on.
Why do you think we should take time to get off the beaten path and, you know, check out these unique destinations?
I think it's kind of easy to become cynical about travel, to think that we've seen it all and, okay, we see pictures of places online and we think that we've been there. But what we're trying to do is keep that sense of awe alive, realize that it's worth cultivating a sense of discovery and walking down that alley. What's at the end of it? What might be at the end of your street, in your state, in your country? That's what we want to inspire people to think about.
And it seems like a part of the point here is this might be the stuff that the locals know about. They know about this weird thing, like you say, at the end of the alley or at the edge of the woods. But the tourist, we wouldn't know about that coming in.
Right. I mean, if you take a place like within Wisconsin, the House on the Rock, that's an incredible place that if you're from Wisconsin, you probably know about. But if you haven't been there, it's this incredible big house full of strange and mysterious
Everything.
Yeah. Chandeliers and strange musical contraptions and a giant carousel that lights up. And those are the kinds of places that we like to share. We have this website. We've created a database that has about 10,000 places now. And these all come from, well, the vast majority come from user submissions who are like, yes, I remember when I was growing up on my street, there was this guy who built a strange machine. And I think that's still there. I think you should go see it. So the book is 700 of those places. We really tried to distill what is the best of the best. What are the greatest hits?
Yeah. How do you decide what is the best of the best? Because a lot of the stuff is really out there and obscure.
Yeah. I mean, there's like a blood waterfall in Antarctica, for example. What we tried to do was balance both geographically and in terms of subject matter. So we wanted to get a lot of natural wonders in there. We have a lot of like glowworm caves and synchronized fireflies. We have a lot of these amazing creative art projects or buildings. Like there's a former monk in Madrid who just decided to spend decades of his life building a cathedral by hand. Those sorts of things. We really wanted to get a mix between like the strange museums, the roadside attractions, but everything makes you think about looking at life from a different perspective, whether that's via a natural wonder or through someone else's strange and wondrous imagination.
And yeah, you mentioned the weird and unusual museums. One of the things that struck me, we can go to a place, I can't remember where it is now, where you can find a jar that contains Thomas Edison's last breath.
Yes.
Was that it?
There is a test tube. It's in Dearborn, Michigan at the Henry Ford Museum. The tale is a little bit, I think there's a bit of drama been put into the tale, but basically I believe it was Thomas Edison's son who was sitting with him during his final moments, and he noticed that there was a rack of test tubes in the room, and he took one, he uncorked it, and he swiped it in the vicinity of Thomas Edison. So technically that test tube can be said to contain, say, one of Thomas Edison's last breaths, but his son sent it to Henry Ford because the two of them are very good friends, and that's why it's at the Henry Ford Museum in Michigan.
I've been to the Henry Ford Museum a lot, and I don't remember seeing that test. I've got to explore it next time I'm back there.
Well, this is the thing. Like, we're trying to point out even individual objects in places you may have been. Like, there's a museum in Florence that contains a glass egg that has Galileo's middle finger inside. And that's not necessarily something that you would know. It's hidden there among the scientific instruments, but we want to point these things out to you.
One of the things I did was page right to the last place I lived, which was Louisiana, and I checked to see how many places I had been on the Louisiana entry. One of the places I really liked that you had mentioned was the Louisiana State Penitentiary Rodeo. The Angola Rodeo, as they call it, and every October. And I'm wondering, did you, travel to some of these places to verify some of these really outlandish things that people were, that you were curating?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that when we were compiling the book, because it covers the world, we unfortunately couldn't go to every single place, but we went to as many places as possible, and we definitely delved into the resources of our community, because it was mostly people telling us about their hometown or places that they were excited about. So that's who we went to first, but it was fun to look through the list and think, oh, where do I want to go next? I did end up going to Poland, to this salt cathedral, and licking the wall to see if it did actually taste like salt. It did. I can verify that. I fact-checked that.
We are talking to Ella Morton. She's with Atlas Obscura, co-author of the new book, Atlas Obscura, An Explorer's Guide to the World's Hidden Wonders. She's with us in the studio, speaking tomorrow at the Wisconsin Book Festival, 9 o'clock, Madison Public Library's Central Branch. So the book is organized by place. The website is organized by kind of however you want to search it. But when you go places, Ella, and when users of Atlas Obscura go places, are they collecting? They're looking at the places other people have put up and then going and notching yet another weird attraction?
Definitely that's happening. We have a lot of people saying to us, before I go anywhere, I will check the Atlas to see what to go and look at. But we also find that people, as well as making a list and checking off that list of places to go, just having this collection of places and paging through it with the book or scrolling through it on the website, it expands your sense of what is out there and what is possible, and it encourages you to look for your own places. So there is that aspect of, you know, finding very concrete locations to go and visit, but it's also about changing your mindset when you travel.
How has editing this work, which is thick, how has editing it changed your perspective, your views of the world?
Oh, in so many ways. I think that I'm less inclined to assume that I know the story behind something, because during the research process, there were so many times that I thought I knew what I was looking at, and it turned out I had no idea at all. The backstory was so much more fascinating than I had ever hoped. And there are things that look different than what they actually are. There's this, one of my favorite places in the Atlas is a place I actually went to when I was maybe 8 years old. It's in New Zealand, and it's a cave where there are glow worms on the ceiling in the dark above this subterranean river. And if you look at the photo, it looks like an entire universe, but it's just this cave of glow worms. And there are so many things like that where you think you know what you're looking at, but the story is completely different. So that's what I look for now.
Yeah. Is there something special about seeing these sites? And, you know, like I said, I go to the Empire State Building. I'm in line with literally thousands of people at a time. Is there something more special, like, hey, this is me and maybe this handful of other people who have gone out of our way to see this thing?
It definitely does make you feel like you're part of a secret club. And that's something that we have had to weigh. We get the question a lot, like, are you overexposing these places? Are you worried that the more you talk about them, the less special that they will become? Mm. But we have found that the vast majority of the places are, say, a small museum that may be in danger of closing because no one's visiting it. And so letting people know about these places, it's giving these places some love. It's ensuring that they can thrive and survive.
How has crowdsourcing this effort made this a more powerful, you know, atlas, a more powerful effort? Has crowdsourcing really helped this?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no way this book would exist if not for crowdsourcing. But I think it also taps into, I mean, you mentioned that the first place you looked at was a place that you had lived. And people do take that approach when you hand them the book. They're like, oh, what's in my state? What's in my neighborhood? And people really have that sense of pride. Like, they want to share what they know with the world, and they have a sense of pride about their locality. So we've definitely tapped into that spirit.
Yeah, I can feel that. Yeah. I went exactly to where. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about living vicariously through this, because I'm opening the book. I'm not going to go to Iraq probably and see the Quran that Saddam Hussein had written in his own blood. I'm not going to see that eternal fire in Turkmenistan. But I got to say, looking at these, if I read about most of these things in a novel, I think, oh, come on, you made that up. That's implausible. Here we are reading about all these wondrous things, weird things, and they're real.
They are real. And it's funny, we get a lot of submissions to the website. We keep thinking, That doesn't sound like it could really be true. And then we check it and it is true. We actually thought about planting just one false entry in the book, but it would be hard to spot because it's just so much of it sounds so outlandish. But it's definitely fun to look at, even if you know that you will not get to the wooden church at the bottom of Antarctica. It's just amazing to know that it exists.
Where does Atlas Obscura go in the future? Where do you take it from here?
We've had a lot of considerations in mind. One is Astro Obscura, to explore beyond our world.
Rob would be a fan of that.
That'd be cool,
That may require a few more resources, a bit of a larger budget, perhaps.
Oh, to actually go to the places? That might be a bit much.
Might be a bit much, yeah. Might have to scale it back a little bit. But, I mean, there are so many possibilities. One, we've really expanded the website lately to include articles about not necessarily places, but strange phenomena or local linguistics, those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. I wrote an article recently about why the purple Skittle tastes different outside the US.
That is so random.
Yeah, so we're doing things like that. But I think there will definitely be more Atlas Obscura books because there's no way that this incredible world can be contained in 480 pages.
I gotta ask, you people working at Atlas Obscura must have the weirdest travel bucket lists of anyone. What are the ones that you're like, okay, it'd be a tall order to get there, but I gotta see that someday?
A lot of mine are, well, I think I mentioned earlier the Flaming Hole in the Turkmenistan desert. That's a perlet. That is a, in 1971, there were these Soviet geologists who were digging for, looking for natural gas, and they dropped their drilling rig. They dropped their drilling rig in this big hole in the desert in Turkmenistan, and it's been on fire for the last 45 years. It's 200 feet wide. It looks incredible. I would like to go there.
Wow, that's a big bonfire.
Yeah. I'd bring some marshmallows for sure.
I better ask before I forget, are you going to hit House in the Rock or the Forever Tron or any of the other Wisconsin sites while you're here?
You know what? I want to see the Mustard Museum.
Oh, yeah. That's a close by trip.
That's on my list. Yeah, that I can easily get to in an afternoon.
All right, Ella, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Ella Morton, co-author of the book Atlas Obscura, also the website of the same name. She speaks at the Wisconsin Book Festival tomorrow night at 9 at the Madison Public Library Central Branch.
Coming up after the news, a self-taught cook shares recipes for making flavorful West African dishes. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we'll talk about the week's biggest state news, including the latest on Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race with two debates and new polling numbers.
First, our next guest is a cook who says she was never taught formally, but got all her training from her mother, who is renowned throughout their West African community for her creative cooking.
Margaret Ellis says she always marveled how her mother could pull together a great meal from nothing. This was especially true during food shortages, which she says were common when she was growing up in the small West African nation of Gambia.
The creative things she learned from her mother helped Ellis to create dishes as varied as creamy shrimp, grilled pepper fish, and peanut butter chicken, all recipes she shares in her new book.
Margaret Ellis joins us now. She's the author of West African Perspective, Recipes Inspired by Gambian Cuisine. Margaret, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as we heard here in this opening, you learned to cook from your mother. What are some of the most important things that you learned from her that she passed down to you?
She passed down her creativity because my mother, growing up, I'm from a family of eight, and my parents were not rich because my dad was a school teacher earning minimum income, and my mother was a housewife. So she learned to feed eight children, a family of 10. And she also managed, my dad and my mom raised other kids in addition to their own eight children. So we had a big family of maybe about 20 people or so living in my house growing up. And she managed to feed them on that income using her creativity.
Yeah, talk about that creativity more. How did she manage, given that some ingredient might be available one day and not the the next? How did she improvise to make meals for all those people?
My mother learned some natural preservation techniques. So we watch her when there was a lot of fish, abundance of fish. My mother will take some of the fish, salt it, and dry it. Or she will smoke some and then dry it after smoking it so she can keep it in the pantry and it will stay preserved without any kind of preservatives added. And then when there was scarcity of fish in the market, we didn't eat fresh fish on those days. My mother will go to maybe the fish she had smoked and dried, or just the regular dried fish. She will look around for some beans, look around for some peppers and tomatoes that she dried and pounded. She will combine all the ingredients that are available to her that day to come up with a meal.
So introduce us to West African cuisine, you know, to someone who has never sampled it before. What's it like?
I would say that we like spices because we believe that savory seasonings stimulate the appetite. So we cook with a lot of spices. I would also say that West African cuisine can be heavy in nature because we cook with a lot of ingredients and we like to cook with oil. And we serve, complement our dishes as stew. We usually complement it with something like rice or bread. So it can be very heavy if you just think about it or see it for the first time. And that's why I had to do a lot of work in presenting my recipes so they can look lighter and they can look more delicious and delightful.
Talk about the spices a little. What kind of spices do we have to have ready to go if we're going to try some of these recipes?
Some of the regular spices that goes in most of my meals are garlic. We eat a lot of garlic, black pepper, regular cayenne pepper. We do a lot of fresh or habanero peppers. And those are just salt. We love salt. And in the Gambia, growing up and up until this minute, we eat with a lot of Maggi cubes and different kind of cubes to add onto our dishes. And recently, I've been doing some research and found out that those are not so healthy for us. So those will definitely not be appearing in the Volume 2 cookbook.
So you've adapted your recipes a little bit for, you know, to make them healthier. Tell us a little bit about the cooking methods you've been using most often in these recipes, like braising and grilling.
We love to grill and we love to fry. So frying and grilling are really two methods of Gambian cuisine. And that's what I have tried to substitute that with baking or broiling and cooking the same recipe, but with some creativity with it. So how can I substitute having to fry dish in deep fry it in oil to baking it because that's healthier and it's lighter, but using the same exact ingredients because those are skills my mother taught me.
We're talking to Margaret Ellis. She's the author of the book West African Perspective, Recipes Inspired by Gambian Cuisine. We've got a couple of her recipes she's shared with us on the Central Time Facebook page. And Margaret, let's look at one of those recipes now. You sent us one for tasty mango chicken. Again, we have shared that. Tell us the story of how you came up with this recipe.
So tasty mango chicken is one of my creations. I grew up, and even today, eating a lot of grilled chicken and grilled fish. So this particular evening, I was expecting some guests, and I wanted to wow them because I have this reputation that I'm very good at cooking. So when I have guests, the bar gets raised. So I grilled the chicken tenderloins with the regular ingredients, and I looked around. I'm like, okay, so usually I'll grill it and make some onions and serve it with lettuce. And then this evening, I'm like, what can I do to make this a special meal? So I opened my pantry, and there was sitting a really round, nice mango that was ripe enough. And if it had stayed another day or so, it may have started to get rotten. So I thought, you know what? Instead of just cooking my onions the same regular way I used to cook them, how about add a new ingredient to my onions? How about add the mangoes, slice it, add it. Mangoes are tropical fruit. I grew up eating it. I eat it still. My kids love it. So I thought I'll add mangoes, and how about a mango gravy instead of an onion gravy?
And what are some of the favorite go-to recipes that you really enjoy cooking and that, you know, are ones you can go to in a pinch?
It would be, I love peanut butter chicken. That's, I had it last week. And I also love the pineapple curry. That's one of my favorites. Because I grew up eating shrimp, and this is shrimp and curry. And all I did was add some pineapples to spice it up.
We're talking to Margaret Ellis about the creative recipes in her book, West African Perspective, Recipes Inspired by Gambian Cuisine.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you tried West African food? What do you like about it? Is it part of your family's heritage? What questions do you have for our guest? Do you need some advice? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. While you're there, find Margaret's recipes for mango chicken, tasty mango chicken. We talked about that a little. We'll also get into some West African rice salad in a bit.
And we'll hear more about West African cooking here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're picking up the conversation about cooking with a West African perspective. We'd like to hear from you. What questions do you have about cooking more creatively or with a West African flair? Have you tried food from West Africa, or what are your favorite dishes? Is this the kind of food you grew up with? Our number is 800-642-1234, or you can post to our Central Time Facebook page.
Margaret Ellis stays with us. Her book is West African Perspective, Recipes Inspired by Gambian Cuisine. We have a couple of those recipes, a mango chicken and a West African rice salad, on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers at 800-642-1234. Shane is with us in Beloit. Shane, hi.
Hi there. How are you guys doing?
Good. What did you want to ask about?
So I was just curious. My girlfriend and I are really into cooking and trying new things. So I was just curious, what would be a good dish to start with to really try to explore more West African dishes?
Shane, that's a great question. Margaret, I could use that too. What's a good, maybe easy, hard to mess up recipe we could start with?
That would be hard to... You know, Shane, I would say that season some chicken. Start with seasoning them with, if you have black pepper, some cayenne pepper, vinegar, salt to taste. Go ahead and season it and let it sit for about 3 hours. Season it, grill the chicken, and then make some onion gravy. Are you familiar with making onion gravy, Shay?
I am not.
Okay. Onion gravy is easy to make. Dice the onions. You can use the same spices I just mentioned, black pepper, cayenne pepper, salt to taste. Without the vinegar, warm up a little bit of olive oil, just a little bit. Don't heat it up, just warm it up. Add the onions in it with all the spices. Saute it until the onions get clear. You can add a drop of, water if you want to, or you can just saute it until it gets clear and soft and have it together. And if you like your food tasty, I would add a tablespoon of vinegar. If you have rice vinegar or some the white vinegar, rice or white vinegar.
All right, Shane, hope that helps. And bring some by after you make that.
Well, and Deborah, we want to ask you, right before we went to break, we mentioned peanut butter chicken. Can you walk us through peanut butter chicken? Also on our Facebook page, someone asked about that as well.
Yes, that's one of my favorites. So it's seasoned similar to the seasoning methods I just shared. We eat a lot of vinegar. We like seasoning with spices. So vinegar, some black pepper, some cayenne pepper, add some salt. If you have other seasonings like lemon pepper and garlic, always you season it, let it sit for a little bit to marinate. Then what I do is I steam it with just the seasoning, the liquids in the seasoning, just the vinegar. Steam it for about 5 minutes. That's just to get the bones to get it to cook quicker. And then the peanut butter is seasoned with the residue from the steamed chicken. So the chicken gets steamed. When it cools, take it out of the pot. And whatever liquids are remaining in the pot, You warm it up, add the peanut butter in it, just a couple of tablespoons of peanut butter. Melt the peanut butter, add some more spices if you would like cayenne pepper, black pepper, the powder, black pepper and the powdered garlic, salt to taste. You dip the chicken in the peanut butter, roll it to make sure it's got enough of it, and put it on the grill. This recipe is, the chicken is finished on the grill. So you steam it first, dip it in the peanut butter paste, and then grill it.
Well, that sounds fantastic. I've had great peanut butter chicken before, but I've never known how to make it. I definitely want to try that one. Let's go to another caller at 800-642-1234. Brendan is with us in Madison. Brendan, hi.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I lived in the Gambia in West Africa for about 2.5 years in the Peace Corps, so this is all exciting to hear on the radio because I love West African food, and I think it's certainly very accessible and very underappreciated in the United States. I wanted to just mention and see if your guest had any recommendations for making chicken yassa, which is a classic dish from Senegal and the Gambia that has, I always like it with lime and onions, but and chicken or fish. So I just didn't know if you make it or if it's something that you make regularly, if you had any recommendations.
Brendan, thanks. Yassa it was, Margaret? And it sounds like yes indeed, you know something about yassa.
That's very popular. That's very popular. So Brendan, thank you for calling, but yassa is made two different ways. So sometimes we would grill fish or grill chicken and then make some onions with just the side dish is not cooked. It's raw onions with lemon, some salt, and some pepper. You can eat yassa that way, spicy. Or when I cook it here at home, what I do is I grill the chicken or the fish just like I did in the past. But this time around, I will saute the onions, season it with the lemon juice and everything, but saute just a little bit. And then pour it over the chicken or the fish, throw it in the oven for about 10 minutes. And that gives it a different taste.
We're talking with Margaret Ellis. She's the author of West African Perspective, Recipes Inspired by Gambian Cuisine. And Margaret, I wanted to ask you about the West African rice salad. You suggested pairing it with the tasty mango chicken. The recipe is also on your website. You know, why this rice salad? What do you love about it?
Well, this was an inspiration from my niece who still lives in the Gambia, and she's a chef. She works for a major hotel in the Gambia. And we grew up, rice is part of Gambian recipes. Everything almost is the staple food, so most families eat rice at least once, twice, or three times a day. So I grew up eating rice, and most of my dishes are complemented with rice. But this time around, like I mentioned earlier, I was expecting guests and I wanted to wow them. I didn't want them to just give them white rice. They're used to seeing white rice. So I decided, my niece had shared with me that, you know, you can make rice into salad. I said, salad? She gave me different ideas. But this day I decided to try adding some of the ingredients she told me I could add to it. And of course I had to add my own twist to it. So I added the extra ingredients to make it Margaret's recipe.
So what were the secret ingredients for Margaret's version of this rice salad?
I added the golden raisins and the fresh parsley. Those were my additions.
Mm. I wanted to ask you one thing about your childhood, Margaret. I understand, of course, you had the big extended family, but you started cooking family meals at a very young age. Do you remember what those dishes were, and have any of them made it into your cookbook?
Yes, actually, in the cookbook, we do have a section that's just dedicated to Gambian dishes, both in the lunch and the dinner section. And I started cooking at the age of 8, and I was cooking most of those recipes. I would cook fish pepper soup. My mom had to start me very light and simple, and then transition into the heavier, more complicated recipes. So we started with making some what we call mbahal, and that's, you cook what looks like pepper soup, but then you You have to take the fish out of the dish and add the rice into the pot and cook it together. And then that's how she started with the pepper soups and the light dishes like the peanut butter stew. I had to start with that as well. And also what we call Benachin is very famous. It's similar to the other one, the mahal, but the Benachin, you have to fry the fish instead of just cooking it fresh.
I've got to Go ahead, Margaret.
So that's how I started light and then transitioned later. By the time I reached 8-12, I was cooking everything.
And Margaret, I've got to ask, it sounds like a lot of times you don't really start with the recipe and you go out and find the ingredients and then come back and cook them. Do you often start saying, hey, what's around, what do I have available, what's in season, and then just work out the recipe from there?
Right. That's what we are taught to do. We are taught to look around, scout around the house to see what we have at hand before we head out to the market. Because if you buy anything my mom already has at home, you get in great trouble. So we always start with looking around, what do we have at hand, and that whatever we have available is will be the decision-making tool for what we eat today.
And let's go to another caller at 1-800-642-1234. You know, do you have a question about West African cuisine? Call us 1-800-642-1234. And we're going to go to Keon from Madison. Hi.
Hi. This is a very innovative store, and I congratulate your guest for this initiative. I'm curious to know, I'm from West Africa, I'm from Ivory Coast, and I'm curious to know if your guest does make some other West African countries dishes.
We've got kind of a bad connection. I'm going to jump in, Keon. I gather, Margaret, he's from Ivory Coast, and he's wondering if you cook things from Ivory Coast as well, and he's wondering, as an Ivorian himself, what's the main dish in Gambia he should try out?
Well, I do have a collection of recipes that other West Africans have shared with me. In this cookbook, I included recipes from Senegal. I included a recipe from Ghana. In the volume 2, I would have recipes from Senegal, from Congo, and Ghana and Cameroon. So I haven't had any Ivory Coast recipes yet, but I'm including more West African or African recipes in general.
Margaret, what do you hope that cooks and families take away from your cookbook? What do you want them to really appreciate?
Well, two things. One is that there's a benefit for a mother to teach her child responsibility and cooking skills at a very young age. My mother didn't know she was raising an author. She didn't know she was raising a speaker. She just knew she had a daughter. Life was hard. Life was difficult. But she did the right thing by raising us and teaching us cooking skills. And she never knew that what she taught me at home in the Gambia would ever get to this point, to the United States, and I would ever be speaking about it. So that's one thing, is parents, including children, including families, and that culture of families cooking together and eating together seems to be fading in our society. So I have a passion for bringing back families and bringing back that tradition of cooking at home and encouraging family time. That's definitely one thing.
Do you find go ahead.
No, another vision that I have is getting involved with young people myself, because I have a cooking show where I invite moms and daughters. We get to cook together, and then after cooking, we have a sit down, and we're able to talk about family. How can we bridge this gap between parents and children? I have my own children, and they think I'm weird sometimes because I'm born and raised in Africa, raised in a totally different society with different values and mindset. So sometimes it's hard for them to understand me. And so it's better if we are able to sit down to share just challenges and share ideas as parents.
Well, Margaret, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your recipes with us.
Thank you. I'm so glad you invited me.
We've been talking to Margaret Ellis. She's the author of the book West African Perspective, Recipes Inspired by Gambian Cuisine. We've got two of the recipes she shared with us and talked about today on the Central Time Facebook page, Tasty Mango Chicken and West African Rice Salad. And a great thing that I want to do more of, she's just talking about cooking with kids.
Yes.
I've just started to try to get back on track with doing that lately. Do you do that?
I do. I always try to incorporate my kids into the kitchen as much as possible, whether it's mixing the waffle mix this morning or, you know, mixing and cracking eggs. It's all a great first step.
And one of my daughters is into baking, but just chocolate chip cookies so far, and I've been able to work with her. And I got to say, there's just nothing but upside there. You know,
yeah.
She's learning how to cook stuff, and I get to eat lots of chocolate chip cookies. Again, find those recipes over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Election season so far has been a source of stress and anger more than laughter, and a lot of the comedy has been at the expense of one side or the other.
At a charity fundraiser last night, both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump tried to get laughs. Traditionally, this event has been a chance for self-deprecating humor. Both candidates focused a little more on deprecating their opponent.
So who can bring laughs from both sides? That would be the legendary Weird Al Yankovic. Took a stab at it by stepping in as a moderator for an auto-tuned version of this week's debate.
We have so many adversaries overseas. Can we all agree to be frenemies?
I would work with our allies in the Middle East. That's the only way we're going to keep the peace.
Okay. Muscle, so sad.
It's a catastrophe. So bad.
So Weird Al, big part of my youth, I gotta say, from the Eat It days and I Love Rocky Road and all of that. And he's still at it some decades later.
Yeah. And bringing that fresh material of today, I remember his Eat It days. I would sing along with him.
Maybe a fourth debate moderated by Weird Al Yankovic. This is Central Time.
We need to get the drug lords.
Come on, wait until we bow.
You get shot walking to the store.
Donald
got into a Twitter war.
The Supreme Court, who